Wonderful. Okay. Hello and welcome, dear colleagues, friends, and guests of the Sufi Studies Network. Before we begin, I would like to acknowledge country, its custodians, past and present. It is my distinct pleasure to open our series of talks for 2024, which will be our fourth year in the series since we began, and that's very exciting. I'm pleased to announce also that I will be joined by my co-host, Neyra Salihbegovic, I hope I pronounced that correctly, who is a PhD candidate at Monash, studying under our esteemed colleague, Dr. Ida Gankars. Neyra will start off today's event by introducing our distinguished guest speaker. Now, over to you, Neyra.
Thank you so much, Milad. Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to see you all here. So, yes, it's my great privilege to introduce Dr. Faris Abdelhadi, who will be presenting a talk today on shedding light on Ibn Arabi's solar metaphor, religious pluralism. So, Dr. Faris Abdelhadi is a Jordanian independent academic who completed his PhD from the University of Exeter in 2022 on the subject of Ibn Arabi's inclusivism, with a focus on the way the Sheikh conceptualizes non-monotheistic religions. With a background in commercial law and business, Faris is currently in the process of publishing his thesis and has a special interest in the way Akbarian frameworks can be used to approach other religions. So, Dr. Abdelhadi, you'll have about 30 to 35 minutes to deliver the talk. Once you're finished, we'll ask Dr. Aydoğan Kars from Monash Uni to deliver a response, and then afterwards we'll open the floor to the general audience for Q&A. So, Dr. Abdelhadi, whenever you're ready, please, feel free to begin.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Neera, for that introduction. And of course, thank you to Aydoğan for organizing this presentation. So this presentation is based on my thesis, which I will be publishing with Routledge soon, hopefully. And it concerns the problem of religious diversity and what Ibn Arabi has to say about religious diversity and other religions. And as I think anyone who has broached the topic knows, Ibn Arabi is a key figure in the topic of religious pluralism. And I think what makes him so interesting, a figure to talk about, is that he arguably bridges the gaps between Islam and other religions, in very particular and creative and unique ways. Not many people have discussed what he has to say about the non-Abrahamic religions. So that's what I want to talk about today, to see how does he conceptualize his teachings with regard to the non-Abrahamic religions and what he has to say about them. Can they be included within the fold of Islam? Can he be inclusive? If so, to what degree? Now, before I begin, I should note that there is an ongoing academic debate raging, if you like. Maybe that's not the right word, but there is an academic disagreement with regard to whether Ibn Arabi himself is inclusivist or exclusivist. So I touch upon that very lightly, but it's not the focus of this presentation. Now, there is a key passage you may or may not have come across, but I'm going to repeat it anyways. And this is the focal passage which is used to center his teachings on his views on the other religions and what does he have to say about them. This passage broadly summarizes his views in that respect. So the passage reads thus: "So all the revealed religions are lights. Among these religions, the revealed religion of Muhammad is like the light of the sun among lights of the stars." So he's using a metaphor to conceptualize Islam's relation to other religions. So then he says, "When the sun appears, the lights of the stars are hidden, and the lights are included in the light of the sun." And so what he is describing here is the phenomenon, it's the legal phenomenon of abrogation. So I will have a bit more to say about that in a minute. Their being hidden is like the abrogation of the other revealed religions that takes place through Muhammad's revealed religion. Nevertheless, they do in fact exist. just as the existence of the light of the stars is actualized. This explains why why we have been required in our all-inclusive religion to have faith in the truth of all messengers and all the revealed religions. They are not rendered null, bottled by abrogation. That is the opinion of the ignorant. Now, there is, like I said, disagreement as to what exactly this key passage means in the writings of Sheikh Al-Akbar amongst academics. Now, in the previous century, it was taken for granted that Ibn Arabi was more or less a pluralist, but those assumptions have become more challenged recently. And I think it is fair to challenge at least some of those assumptions if we're going to be objective as to who he is. There is a challenge to this more romantic notion, this more romantic image as to who exactly he is. Is he all-inclusive religious pluralist, or is he maybe constrained by the times and conditions of his era, in which case he would have been normally an exclusivist? But whether you subscribe to one camp or the other, you will hold this passage to be very important, which is why it's important to unpack it correctly, if you like. Now, this is not what the presentation is about, so I can't get into it, but I spend about two chapters in the book unpacking this metaphor. But just to briefly summarize those findings, what I argue is that they're both positions are at least partly correct. The previous religions prior to Islam's coming are partly annihilated, are partly canceled out, if you like, and they also, but they nevertheless continue to remain in some manner. So what I realize is that there is a Sufi metaphor which other academics may not have either picked up on or may not have spoken about, and that is the metaphor of annihilation and subsistence, fana and baqa. So with respect to fana and baqa, the lights of the stars are being annihilated in some respect, but they continue to subsist nevertheless. And the whole book, the remainder of the book, is trying to discover what exactly that means. Now, they remain in some manner after Islam's coming. So there needs to be a legal mechanism which permits them to remain. Now, one of the mechanisms, or perhaps the only one that scholars have talked about, is the jizya. Now, I will talk about Gregory Lipton's position in a minute, because he is an important figure in the camp of exclusivism, holding that Ibn Arabi was in fact a exclusivist. This is going to be strongly related to Ibn Arabi's notion of what beliefs are. And I think this is a very important point, because much of what Ibn Arabi has to say about pluralism lies in the concept of beliefs and what beliefs are, and the way we understand his passages and explanations of beliefs. So his famous ideas on pluralism tend to come from this one concept. So for example, there's a famous passage from the Fusus al-Hikam where he says, "Beware of limiting yourself to a specific belief and rejecting the rest." Now, Gregory Lipton, who is an important proponent for conceiving Ibn Arabi as an exclusivist, disagrees with this reading, and he takes it to mean it is a form of political theology of exclusion, but I won't explain why right now. The details of that are in the book. But what he is basically saying is that scholars have mixed up Ibn Arabi's understanding and conception of what law, Sharia, is and what beliefs are. So the Sharia and i'tiqadat, these are two distinct and separate concepts, or deen and i'tiqadat. So he says that they are not interrelated, and we have to treat them separately. So that whenever Ibn Arabi talks about Sharia, that tells you what his views are with regard to soteriology. And soteriology means whether they are saved or not, whether they are to be included under the fold of Islam or not. Whereas i'tiqadat is something else entirely, according to his view. I disagree with this reading strongly, but it does raise two questions. Is the payment of the jizya the only way to remain in one's religion? So, for example, when Jews and Christians pay the jizya, they are permitted to practice their religions under an Islamic domain, but it also has salvific consequences in the next life for Ibn Arabi. In other words, they are saved when they do that. And so is the jizya payment the only way to conceptualize Ibn Arabi's pluralism? I think that's a very narrow way to view it. So I don't agree that the jizya is the only way to think about his pluralism. And then the second question is, should beliefs and either religion or law be treated separately? So before we get into that, just let me briefly summarize what he has to say about the notion of beliefs, i'taqadat. It comes from the word aqada, which means to knot or to tie. And so beliefs govern our perception of reality and define the boundaries of what we recognize or deny. So it is your view of reality which you tie as a knot in the heart. And so if something contradicts that perception and view of reality, you deny it. But if it matches what is the knot in your heart, if it matches that perception in your heart, then you accept it. That's the idea of i'taqadat. It defines the boundaries of what you accept or what you reject. And so Ibn Arabi's major precept for this idea is that God manifests himself to you in the form of your belief, no matter what that belief is. So if you belong to any one of the religions, God manifests himself to you in the form of your belief, regardless of what that religion is. And it's based on such scriptural data as أَيْنَمَا تُوَلُّوا فَثَمَّ وَجْهَ اللَّهِ, wheresoever you turn, there is the face of God. But what is the precise connection between the Sharia and beliefs? Are they interrelated in any way? And I argue that they are strongly interrelated. One shapes the other, and one influences the other. And so I think there are many passages in Ibn Arabi's writings that suggest we can easily go beyond the jizya in order to conceptualize what is his understanding of religious pluralism and how other religions are included. If Ibn Arabi does believe in abrogation, which I believe he does, nevertheless, he is strongly inclusivist with regard to how we include other religions. So I will be providing some examples to demonstrate this. In this slide, he talks about the idea of spiritual stations. The Sufi spiritual stations are these degrees of sainthood, wilaya, which are open to the saint who wishes to acquire them. And then they raise him in degrees of sainthood. Now, this is what Ibn Arabi has to say about this idea. Know that the companion of the book, so he says, Ashab al-Kitab, like the Jew or Christian, if he fulfills a command of his book, that which was revealed prior to its abrogation by our law, and he renounces the world, just as the Sufis have done, then he too attains to these way stations and spiritual influxes, these munazalat and waridat, as God wishes. So these spiritual stations are open to them too. And it seems to me that the way he uses the phrase companion of the book suggests that if there are other religions with revealed books prior to the coming of Islam, you know, could we say the same thing about Hindus and Buddhists, for example, the Vedas and the Upanishads? I think he is implying that, even if he doesn't say it explicitly. And he drops these hints in other places too. Here's the second passage from the Kitab al-Tajaliyat, where he says, how many walk upon the earth whilst the earth curses him? How many prostrate themselves upon her, but she does not accept it? In other words, their prayers. How many preachers whose words do not go beyond their lips or thoughts beyond their minds? And yet how many a beloved saint, Wali Habib, is to be found in synagogues and churches? And the Arabic uses for these words is al-kana'is wal-bi'ah. And yet how many a hated enemy are to be found in prayer rooms and mosques who does this for the sake of that, but he's only reckoning what is he going to get out of it for himself? In other words, he's not sincere. So I think that's a pretty clear passage that saints are to be found in other religions too. And then Ibn Saldikin has a commentary on this passage too. Then there's chapter 36 from the Futuhat, where he says that Christians derive their sainthood from the spiritual reality of Jesus, and Jews derive their sainthood from the spirituality of Moses. Albeit after coming from Islam, it all this derives from the Mishkat of Muhammad. So the word Mishkat translates into niche, which is a metaphor for the concept of abrogation, in which even though the previous religions are abrogated, they still retain the spiritual realities of the previous prophets and therefore the other religions. And so saints from other religions still have access to their sainthood, but this time, albeit it goes to the niche of Muhammad, but their sainthood still exists. And then he talks about the philosophers who practice spiritual exercises and are capable of releasing the powers of the spirit. But he makes a distinction between those who follow a divinely revealed law and those who don't. Those who do not follow a divinely revealed law do not have access to divine stations, but they have access to the spiritual stations. And he gives an example from his own life when he says, when someone who did not believe in the revealed religions participated with us in exercises and spiritual struggles and strove to purify a soul from the grip of its physical nature, and that's a very common key theme in philosophy, pre-modern philosophy, then he established a connection with the pure spirits. And so I think there's an obvious connection with that to the Quran from Surah Al-Shams, which says, قَدْ أَفْلَحَ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا. So he who purifies her, that's the soul, then he is saved. So those are some examples that show, I think we can obviously go beyond the jizya in order to conceptualize other religions. And if we're stuck with the idea of the jizya, that's a very narrow take on what his religious pluralism is. Now, I want to show why the notion of law and beliefs are intertwined. The law confirms your beliefs in one respect, and your beliefs in turn shape the law. So here's one example. Now, from chapter 305 of the Futuhat. Now, there is something called a circle of esotericism, which is rejected in academia, and I think quite rightly so, which says that the closer you get to the center of a religion and its esoteric dimension, then the closer you are to the truth, and therefore you're automatically saved. I don't think Ibn Arabi would have necessarily accepted that understanding of religion just because you're esoteric. It has to be intertwined with the law. But nevertheless, I did find another circle in the Futuhat, which is very fascinating. And it is a circle of poverty, the circle of faqr, dhilla, lowliness, and al-ubuda, servanthood, and being brokenhearted, in kasar al-qalb. So he will give you examples where there's an absolute value attached to realizing one's ontological poverty, which means you are of the belief that you do not own anything, but your life is dedicated to manifesting that practice in which you actualize and realize your ontological indigence and poverty. So it's one of the most prized Sufi stations, and this is what he has to say about it. Know that this quality, i.e. of poverty, which I alerted you to, provide us with a state and witnessing from the presence of sanctity, Hadrat al-Quds. So the presence confirms it. No one is described by it, except he has the highest way stations with God. So if he is a messenger, then he has the highest way station in messengership. And if a prophet, then the highest way station in prophethood. If he's a saint, then he becomes the highest saint. And if he's just a mu'min, a believer, then he has the highest way station in faith. And if he is a Christian or a magian or a Jew or an atheist, mu'attalan, and this is a correct translation because he specifically defines what a mu'attal is from chapter 60 or 62 from the Futuhat, but he tells you specifically what it means. So it's an atheist. Then he is the most elevated, he is in the most elevated way station of his category and station. And then he follows this paragraph with a poem in which he says, the great one among the men is he who does not claim God to be shackled or made master. And it's a play on words, because the word shackled also means delimited, muqayyad, right? Or made master, absolute. He does not restrict God to any one particular quality. And he does not make him Judaized or Christianized or magianized or made non-existent, mu'attilan, or associated or unified. He does not make him munazzah, incomparable, or mushabbah, similar, or spatially confined, or in place, or spiritualized, mutarawah, or corporealized, mutajassad. The attributes of his majesty, and now he is deliberately conflating Insan al-Kamil, perfect man with God, since Insan al-Kamil is God's manifestation on earth. The attributes of his majesty and beauty encompass every creature, doing so purposively and rightly. The truly jealous man, Ghayur, is he who does not avert from himself the state, the hal of misguidance or guidance, because God's presence is to be found in both, albeit you have to see how it conforms to the Sharia. So then Ibn Arabi continues the passage after he has given us this poem. And he says, the locus, i.e. person, in which this attribute of poverty becomes well established in its possessor will necessarily, labud, will necessarily, whatever his sect or creed, return to the religion of guidance. He will submit, believe, and undertake to acquire the noble character traits, the makarim al-akhlaq, based on a verified, unveiling, and correct knowledge. Then he will be the most perfect of people in faith and the mightiest of them in way station in the sight of God, knowing the way station of the messengers and prophets, peace be upon them, and their preference over one another, and the saints and the believers. For the attribute of poverty which led him to Islam, so here he's obviously conflating small Islam with an I with the big Islam with a capital I, the act of submission with the actual confessional religion itself. So it means that with this attribute of poverty, he will necessarily return to that religion, no matter what. Is the mightiest of attributes. Poverty is the mightiest of attributes in God's sight, and in worth for that servant. So he alights upon the supernal way stations, and he is raised in the Iliyin, which is a term taken in the Quran to mean the highest stations in paradise. Every noble angel, and it's also a book, every noble angel will receive him as a sincere doer of good, muhsin, towards God in the worship of his Lord. The angel is the one who descends to that servant from God due to the correlation that is between that angel and him. He takes him by the hand and raises him to the way station of this attribute in the Iliyin. So there'll be no one in his class higher than him in way station except for him who does the same work, for he will be in his rank and with him. Now, the majority of the ideas that Ibn Arabi uses to conceptualize non-Abrahamic religions can be mentioned here, but I will not go through all of them. I'm just giving you a list of what I have discovered so far, but I'm only going to go through a couple of them. But basically, he accepts the idea that not only are there divinely revealed religions, but there are also man-made religions. And so he calls these the Nawamis, the man-made religions, which are invented by man. They're actually invented by the sages. So he accepts the category of sages that exist. So you have prophets and sages. Who don't necessarily receive prophecy, and they don't know what the truth is, but they nevertheless strive to seek God's good pleasure. So God confirms them in it. So from Fawsi Aqib, from the Fusus al-Hikam, he says, these are the laws of the sages, Nawamis al-Hikmiyya, which were not brought by no messenger from God for the people. He placed into the hearts of these sages veneration, ta'zim, of what they themselves have prescribed, seeking God's pleasure in that way. And that is what they believe. وَكَذَلِكَ اعتقدوا, then God confirms them in it. So this is a very obvious example of the intertwinement of law and beliefs. The law confirms your beliefs in specific circumstances. For example, when a prophet is absent, although it's not the only circumstance. So this is one of Gregory Lipton's major blind spots. He has not dealt with the concept of man-made religions. And he says, Ibn Arabi himself does not include specific non-Muslim religious communities in his exposition of this idea of i'tiqadat, in which all beliefs are manifestations of God and are connected to religion and therefore confirming one in one's belief. He says it actually concerns just the mutakallimun within Islam, to demonstrate the limits of rationality. So he says, Ibn Arabi's discourse on belief thus appears to be primarily an intra-religious critique on speculative theology and the metaphysical hazards of rational conceptions of the divine more broadly. Now, this is categorically incorrect, because Ibn Arabi meets a group of people who are sun worshippers in Anatolia, what he calls Bilad Yunan, and he calls them the Shamsiyya. And I don't know who exactly these Shamsiyya are. I couldn't identify them, but I believe it is correct to locate them in Turkey, modern-day Turkey and Anatolia. So Ibn Arabi describes having met them, specifically in the context of beliefs. And so Ibn Arabi is invited to have lunch with one of their scholars, and he is recounting these details in chapters 69 and 72 of the Futuhat. So Ibn Arabi asks the scholar, why do you do shirk? Why are you worshiping the sun along with your worship of God? So then this Greek scholar gives a very interesting response to Ibn Arabi as he records it. And he says, we do not worship the sun in as much as it is the sun. God forbid. God is one God. Our learned scholars simply investigate what benefits this most tremendous light, an-nayr al-azam, which is a technical term in astrology, has in the cosmos. And then the scholar enumerated the benefits God connected to it. And then he continues, so from those benefits, we knew that if the sun did not have solicitude, anaya, from God, he would not have entrusted it to these matters. Hence, we seek nearness to it through veneration, which is the same we encountered before, ta'zim, that we may have a most beautiful intermediary with God for our deliverance. لِيَكُونَ لَنَا أَحْسَنَ وِسَاتْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ فِي تَخْلِيسِنَا. Now, takhlis can also mean for our purification, but obviously salvation and purification are connected concepts, right? So you can translate either way. For us, the sun is a poor slave of God Almighty. Indeed, it is through God that he, and i.e. the sun, is granted solicitude. This is what he said to me whilst we were sitting at his table eating from his banquet. And then Ibn Arabi calls this section the prostration, in other words, the prostration to the sun, the prostration of ijtihad, and exerting oneself to the utmost, because what behooves God's majesty in glorifying and taking pleasure in him. So Ibn Arabi is hinting at us that what these individuals did was a form of ijtihad. And there'll be more to say about that in a minute if I have not run out of time. So there's a second passage. And this is what he says about his meeting with the sun worshiper here. He says, they only worship the sun because they imagine it is a god. So they only prostrate to God, not to the sun itself. Rather, they are bowing down to their own judgment. They ain't helping him fiha, that it is God. I was a guest of one of their scholars, and I learned from him about their worship of the sun and prostration to it. So he said to me, there is nothing but God. So this sun, mathama ilala. So this sun is the closest relation we have to God in terms of what God has placed in it of lights and benefits. Therefore, we exalt it, just as God exalts it by what he has placed in it. So then Ibn Arabi continues, so God knows that they only worship him, right? Even if they err in the ascription, because he manifests himself to them in the form of their beliefs, which means no matter what you worship, you are only worshiping God. That's the metaphysical reality. That's the metaphysical reality, which is then connected to law too. So the believer worships only God. Since this sun worshiper describes himself as a mu'min, and thus resembles the unbeliever, who is the sun worshiper here, in his belief in God. So now there's a similarity between the two. Therefore, the business is like the divine law, which abrogates parts of itself. Here, this belief has no effect on belief, and it is not stronger than it, since the matter is, as we mentioned, in respect of his belief in the God, من اعتقاده الإله, he has the right to do so, or he is in possession of some part of the truth, وذا حق. But in respect of ascribing divinity to the sun, then he is an unbeliever or one who covers up. I think he means more that he is one, as a kafir, he's one who has covered up part of God's reality by covering over his transcendence. So therefore, the real observes the meaning which they intended. So he's legally, technically legally a kafir, but in reality, he's also a believer. It is from here that they are confirmed in and are singled out for prostration to the sun during its times of sunrise and sunset, when it is normally forbidden for Muslims to pray. So they are singled out for prostration during the times, but not the Muslim believers who cannot pray during those times. So the abrogation of the prostration of the believers in that time belongs to God. It is the effect of belief on belief, not the effect of disbelief on belief. So the takeaway points from this passage is that Ibn Arabi is clearly using the notion of abrogation of the divinely revealed laws explicitly to include the sun worshippers, not exclude them in this instance. And so by drawing a parallel between the divinely revealed religions, and obviously law and beliefs are intertwined. God manifested himself to them in the form of their beliefs through which he was worshipped, and their worship became sanctioned through law. And it's interesting. This is one of the earliest recorded proto-interfaith Islamic dialogues with non-Abrahamic religions. So this is a major mistake on Lipton's part. I'm conscious that I've only got about maybe a minute left till we're at 30 minutes. Can I go up to 35 minutes? Is that possible?
Yes, yeah, that should be fine.
Okay, then I'm going to try and wrap this up in 5 minutes. So ijtihad is a legal concept that Ibn Arabi uses. So this is the second concept he uses, and it is a legal concept derived from usul al-fiqh to include non-Abrahamic religions. And it's based on the hadith that the mujtahid, the one performing ijtihad, gets two rewards for striving and hitting the mark, and one reward for getting it wrong, but for still trying. So the mujtahid and the ijtihad only refers to the legal scholar, but Ibn Arabi uses the word mujtahid to mean the salik, the spiritual wayfarer, too. So he extends the meaning of the hadith to anyone who strives to find the truth, not just to the legal scholars. Now, normally, there are two concepts associated with ijtihad, usul and the furu', which means the foundational creed of the religion, and the more legal matters pertaining to the practical application of the religion, which is called the furu'. So there's the root, which is the usul, and there are the branches, which are the furu'. So you can do ijtihad in either one. Now, normally it's forbidden to do ijtihad in the usul, in the roots of the religion, trying to discover what is the nature of God, for example. Because then, according to Imam Juwayni, and his reasoning is, I think, sound. Otherwise, that would mean Zoroastrians, Christians, and atheists would all be right in their ijtihad, right? Which is logically not possible. But Ibn Arabi plainly disagrees with that. He says, our position is that ijtihad is permitted in the principles and in the legal rulings, the furu' al-ahkam. So then he gives examples of this. He says, when he meets Idris in the fourth heaven in his Ma'raj, he says, O founder of the arts and sciences of wisdom, ijtihad in the branches is lawful according to us, and I am speaking for the ulama of the age, he said. And then Idris said, and it is lawful in the roots too, that God only burdens a soul with what it can bear, because these people are also trying to find the truth. And so it would be inconceivable of it would be inconceivably immerciful to punish them for something that's not their fault. So I said, but because of this, the differences concerning the real and the doctrines of him became many. And he said, it could not be otherwise because the affair accords with one's constitution. And that's an explicit example of the law intertwining with metaphysics. And there's another example from his tafsir of the fifth verse of Surah Baqarah. He says that in this verse, there's a glad tiding and a source of corroboration for the one who says that the mujtahid is rewarded, even if he errs, and that ijtihad is permitted in the roots, discovering what God is and what is his nature, just as it is in the branches. And so he becomes felicitous, which means those who are saved from God's wrath remaining in the abode of God's honor. Why? Because the mujtahid always gets one reward for trying. So it's a sanctified station. Here's another example. And I'm going to wrap this up in about 3 minutes or 2.5 minutes. So normally the mushrik, the one who's an associate or polytheist in Islamic law, is punished, normally speaking. But Ibn Arabi makes exceptions for that. He says, but not every associator. Rather, only the associators who were sent to the messengers or did not give rational consideration, another as rightful due, or they did not strive, wala ajtahadu. But the Prophet has reported that the striver mujtahid, if he errs, he is rewarded. He did not separate the branch from the root. No, he generalized. In other words, one is permitted to perform ijtihad in any religious matter. So he verified God's words, my mercy embraces everything, and my mercy has outstripped my wrath through that principle. The Amir Abd al-Jazairi says the same thing. And then he concludes, whoever God apprises of the nobility of this genus, the human species, and of his providential care for them, and how he singled them out by having the heavenly spheres subjected to them, and the prostration of the angels to them, would say, as we have said, that they can be saved through ijtihad, and that they are excused for making a mistake. It is not far-fetched at all as a favor from God. In Sahih Bukhari, the Prophet ﷺ said, if the unbeliever were to know of all that which is with God of his mercy, he would never despair of paradise. And this is the final example, and I won't go through it because we're out of time, but it's one of the most interesting passages with regard to this entire topic. And I call it the mythopoiesis of idolatry. And Ibn Arabi talks about basically, so he's being very nuanced because he recognizes different kinds of idolaters. There are ones who like the Qurayshi Meccans who rebel against the prophets, but there's also ones who are not rebels, but they are striving to find what the truth is. And so he has something very unique to say about that. And so very briefly, he's very sympathetic to this idea. He talks about how in pre-eternity, they're worshiping and witnessing God with their own eyes. But then when they come into this lower world, their eyesight becomes veiled. And so due to an anxiety that arises from them, they need something to worship in order to continue witnessing God. So they make an idol out of anything, a rock, tree, star, river. But he considers this one to be a mujtahid, uses the same concept. And so these idolaters, they also have access to the prophetic teachings. And so they intermix prophetic teachings with their idolatry. And so they are excused for their mistake. And there's more to say about that, but I'm out of time, so I'm not going to get into the details unless I can get extra time. But that's the summary of the idea. So his felicity is absolute, whether he hits the mark or errs. The reward is unquestionably his after having satisfied the right due to intellectual investigation and to ijtihad in his estimation. So he says, it is along these lines you will know what is shirk and what is the attributes of the mushrik. So God has forgiven them from one perspective. He says to them, do not despair of God's mercy, for God forgives the sins, all of them. This is if the servant intentionally does the sin, believing it is a sin. So what is the state of the one who does not intentionally sin and took that mode of worship as a way of becoming near to God? He deserves forgiveness even more. And then this leads back into the diversity of beliefs, which he explains in the following passage, which we can read another time. But just to summarize the presentation, abrogation does not simply mean to cancel out the other religions. It means to include them under the fold of Muhammad's law. And so the stars' lights continue to exist through the Muhammadan sun. That's their abrogation. They don't disappear completely. And so they continue to remain. And there are many examples where Ibn Arabi attributes an absolute value, in other words, to certain actions they do, which means regardless of what religion they're from, they can still be saved, like spiritual poverty or ijtihad. And so this raises the question, are there more? And I'm sorry for rushing that last part, and thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Abdelhadi.